The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
This episode of More Stories with Norman Lear brought to you by True Car. Listen, I don't advertise anything that I don't believe in. True Car, you can get the True Car app or go to TrueCar.com. True Car users like myself save on average over $3,000 off MSRP. What you do is you see what other people are paying for a particular vehicle, and you lock in that price. I have a truck, and I just put my foot down with black rims. That was important to me. I need black rims on this black truck, or I'm out of the business. And they found that car for me for the price I wanted. My phone vibrated. Literally, bzz, it's ready. We got it for you. Save time, save money, never overpay. True Car, my friends. I put my name on it. You will love it. True Car, and also there's used cars or pre-owned if you want to be fancy. And maybe you find yourself a $135 car to go down the Merritt Parkway like Norman Lear did. And it's too bad they didn't have True Car back in the day. You'd have a very fancy $135 car. True Car, my friends. Save time, save money, never overpay. True Car.
Put your name on it. Just put your name on it. That's all I say. Be a man or a woman. Put your name on it.
Well, I'd like to hear about it, pothead.
Look at the game change.
If you want a battle, it's either that you will or you won't.
You know, you're not a bad-looking man, Mr. Gals.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
No, I thought you said that you are right, Spider.
Hey, man!
Norman Lear, at 94 years old?
Yes. Surprise to me.
Is that a surprise that you...
What that means is it's taken me every split second of 94 years, some months, some weeks, some days, to see you with your hand at your chin looking at me say this.
What does my face look like looking at you?
Interested and it's pleasant.
It is entirely pleasant. I tweeted this morning... preparing for at the Norman Lear for more stories. And this is true. I just sat in my room and I started to cry.
Cry?
Yeah. It was the... I'm getting choked up now. The magnitude of what you've done, what you're doing, not realizing in real time, like if I do the Jeffersons, if I do Good Times, if I do All in the Family, that this is going to get inside human beings. This is going to be a visceral thing. If somebody's walking down the street and goes, oh, geez, Edith, they all know it, you know. And it just hit a tuning fork in me that I didn't even know was there. And in real time, when you're creating these characters, I guess if you look backwards.
How old were you when they were in their zenith?
I was about 30, 33. I'm much older than I look, you know.
You are much older than you look, if that's the truth.
I was a preteen.
Yes.
It was something the grown-ups watched. And when the bedtime got pushed to maybe 9, you could add another half hour of Norman Lear.
You were preaching.
I was what now?
Preaching, did you say?
Preteen.
Oh, I was a preteen. I thought you said I was preaching.
Well, I was that also. I beat quite a drum in the day and still do. And it's the drum you wish would get quieter and quieter as you go. Are you aware it? Whatever age you were at when you were creating these characters, it seems impossible that you could be aware of the magnitude and the reach and the time that they would cover.
I wasn't at all. You know, I was working my ass off to make a living for a burgeoning family. I have 6 kids. They're spread, widely spread, because my youngest are 22, twins, and my oldest is 70. So... you know, and I'm thinking about all the writers, because obviously I didn't do this alone. We're great collaborators. But we sat around a table. We were all working people. Everybody's working their hearts out to make a buck, a great buck in this business, but nonetheless working to put kids through school and so forth. That's what we were doing. I view myself as a serious... human being, so I gravitated. Who sees the foolishness of the human condition in anything? I gravitated to those things that I cared most about, and knew there were laughs there because of, you know, the foolishness, as I said, of the human condition. I love that expression. I love finding it in the most difficult circumstances. There's a reason to laugh. And but we weren't thinking about how many people we were reaching or something. That's something we heard on television when they were reporting or read in the paper. Or, you know, we were just working.
You had to have known the import of the content, like abortion, racism, anti-Semitism, misogyny. And I've been in show business, you know, a tiny piece of the pie chart, to know that there's an automatic pushback from the network and from the studio. And I don't know how you guys overcame that. So I would
with ratings. with ratings, we were doing well for them. So
that's it. Money talks. Money talks. That's the foolishness of the human condition.
Yes. You know, there's somebody at the show or at the rehearsal who thinks something is wrong. That somebody is reporting to somebody on the second floor in another building in another part of town, who reports to somebody in the eighth floor in that building, who reports to somebody in New York on the fourth floor, who reports to somebody on the 32nd floor. That's the way it is.
It was the Hemingway quote, it's one thing to speak of bulls, another to be in the bull ring. So you guys are on the floor in real time.
Yes.
And then some guy in New York in the Brillstein building goes, they want to do what? And they're not there on the floor to see the laughs, to see the heart. And that's something that your show's always had, was that incredible heart. You have to answer this question. When was the last time you said dynamite?
Probably in a conversation, repeating it, you know, within the last few weeks, because people talk to me all the time about the shows because I've been running around the country so much.
Never just in your everyday life? Like you just hit a free throw in the driveway and I
never said dynamite. I think I heard dynamite the first time like everybody heard it the first time. It wasn't in the script. It wasn't something when I came into a rehearsal, it was found.
Was it said organically by Jimmy Walker?
I think so. I mean, but that's my memory could fail me there, but I think so.
That's fascinating. That's,
you know, either that or it was innocently in the script. He said dynamite. But the way he said it killed an audience. And such was, you know, in those days, you got to laugh, you repeated it.
Right.
And everybody was grateful for it.
It's almost everything he said got such a laugh, almost disproportionate. Well, I think that's the biggest trap door for a writer and for a performer, is if something gets a laugh, then you say it a little differently because you're aware of it. All of a sudden, these words have such important weight and presence. So the next time in, you say, dynamite! And the next time you go, hey, dynamite. You just keep messing with the word. The worst thing you can tell a performer is do exactly that again. Because we're not aware of it.
So right. Because it interrupts the chemistry between the audience. These shows have live audiences.
Good Times is filmed in front of a live audience. Yeah. It's my favorite show of all time, Good Times.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Why was that?
Because it was... Well, first of all, Delma was just
drawing. I swear to God, I was thinking that.
Yeah.
He's going to say something about Thelma.
We're on the same frequency, for sure. Yeah.
She was as lovely a woman as ever graced the tube.
And to a 13, 14-year-old boy in suburban New Jersey, she was the most exotic. She was a crumb drawing of there's no word for just that. And James just running that house, running that show. And then James goes, and then I remember as a child thinking, how are they going to pull this off without James? Damn. And you guys did. Well, I mean, funny first, it has to be. The elevator's got to go out, and Malone's got to come by. And by the way, Jeanette Dubois, she did the song, I believe.
She wrote the song, yeah.
It was a fantastic song.
She wrote the lyric.
Yeah.
And, having difficulty remembering the name of the guy who wrote the music.
Good old what's his name?
Good old what's his name? Who visited me recently and wondered if there wasn't a musical in the Jeffersons, a Broadway musical.
Oh, she did the Jeffersons and Good Times, didn't she?
She did the Jeffersons. Oh, I was just talking about the Jeffersons.
Who sang the Good Times song? That was another good old, what's her name? I guess. Well, it doesn't matter.
I don't remember.
Here's the good news. It doesn't matter at all. When you're in a writer's room, it's got to be odd as a white Jewish male writing like Jive Turkey. I've been aware of blowback from black people, my friends, that go like, yeah, you have a bunch of Jewish guys sitting around a table writing for black people. Where are all the black writers? And I don't think they were readily available in the 70s.
No, they weren't. But there were some. We had several that were. As a matter of fact, on Good Times, there are two black guys who, they're both black, that you wouldn't know it by their names, but they get credit for creating it.
Shlomo.
Eric Monty and Michael, just lost the last name.
The character James was the strongest man I think has ever been on television, James Evans. And I still, Junior, when the bad guys were coming to get JJ, and he goes, Junior, in your own home, you don't run and hide from nobody. And the crowd, a studio audience is pretty by the numbers. You just hear, you're damn right, like right on. Like, and I went, whoa, that's obviously words to live by, because I was aware of a 22-minute sitcom and the characters and the furniture all make-believe. But this audience went, that is right, what that man said. Your dad having gone to prison, and your dad having, I was watching you speak with my dear friend Whoopi.
Whoopi Goldberg?
Oh,
I love her.
I
love her.
There's no adjectives to describe her magnitude, her love. And your conversation, your honesty about your dad, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would feel disappointed. Did you write on purpose the antithesis of your father? Did you write? Because really, James Evans is the only, like, dad that runs the show. And the other guy is like Archie.
You know where I found fathers also? In our founding fathers. I think, often have thought, that could have attracted me as much as anything else. My father was in prison. Think about it this way. My dad was in prison. I'm 9 years old. I'm living with an uncle, then another uncle, and then finally my grandparents. I'm utterly alone, basically. And I've taken civics lessons in school, and I've learned about what the promises of this democracy are. I am equal to anybody else. And I've also found Father Coughlin, who was a great radio anti-Semite. Hated Jews, hated FDR, hated, you know. Do you know about Father Coughlin?
As Norm MacDonald would say, this guy sounds like a real jerk. But no, I don't know. Do I want to?
Oh, it was very famous. I'm not talking about
somebody. Sorry, I'm a Foley artist as well.
Very well known. I like that.
Then it began to rain during the podcast.
I like that. Jeez, I'm glad I'm not a piece of paper.
I'm glad you're not one also. So Father Coughlin, the founding forefathers, you have this A to Z, these two polar opposites of how a man should behave. Your own father going way over.
Yes, but I learned about my Constitution, my Bill of Rights, my Declaration, and I underlined my in each of those cases, and my Constitution, my country's promises. I am equally important, equally under the law, I am guaranteed equal justice, equal opportunity, and so is the next guy, every next guy. I can't overstate how much that meant to me and how much that helped me get through what I was going through, which is hardly as tough as what the average black kid is going through this day, let alone all those years ago.
So what's promised in the Constitution by the founding forefathers, you are living as a kid, not that. What you are promised, you are experiencing less than in real time. You'd see your brother, he was a World War II hero. He'd flip you a coin. I believe I read someplace every time he saw
you. I didn't have a brother. I had a sister.
It was an uncle.
I was a World War II
somebody used to see you and they'd flip you a coin every time they saw you.
Oh, I had an uncle.
An uncle, excuse me.
Yeah, my Uncle Jack used to
smile.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
He was a press agent. I was a kid of the Depression. So to have an uncle who flicked you a quarter, that guy was my hero. There wasn't anybody else that affected me. It's like this guy flicking me a quarter. And I wanted to be what he was. He was a press agent. I didn't even know what that was. But I wanted to be a press agent. My folks, really, if they expected anything of me, they never told me. So I wasn't going to go to college. They couldn't afford that. I won a scholarship at the last minute. Spent a year at Emerson College, thankfully, in Boston. Then came the war, and I enlisted.
Your Uncle Jack being your hero, if you want to speak of eternal life, the smile on your face when you said Uncle Jack, it was a different Norman Lear. I mean, you're kind, compassionate, you love entirely. And that's my only experience with you was since you came in here.
Yeah.
And it just completely unfolded exponentially when you smile with Uncle Jack.
Well, an awful lot by now, because it's in the book, because it's in the film, because people talk to me about it, because I've talked about it endlessly. Thinking about him is not only the moment he flicked me a quarter and that, it's all these years of joy in relating that.
You wrote about such injustice and the characters you wrote about, yourself experiencing injustice with a father in prison and your parents not really communicating their wishes. And Uncle Jack, I can probably pinpoint to, he saw you. That's where the thermometer starts, is he sees me. There's my guy, Norm. Like you said, it's not the coin. It's, I see you, buddy.
Uh-huh.
Here, and then the coin is extra. And you write with the Jeffersons and Good Times and Archie. There's all these characters. No one's, quote unquote, making it. They are all getting shortchanged by the society, by the town, by the civic leaders. Was that something you set out to do, is I'm going to write?
But they are making it in this sense,
yes,
that they are with family.
Yes.
And they know whether they're accepting it for this day or not. They're loved. Each of them could feel secure in the love of their families.
Some of them impossibly. I don't know how Archie Bunker was loved by Edith. But when I saw, Edith, it's absurd that I'm forgetting her name of all people.
Jean Stapleton?
Thank you. Yeah. Jean Stapleton, I saw an interview where she's talking about when her character died. And she was talking about Carol O'Connor finding the slippers.
Yeah.
She starts to cry.
Yeah.
It was like 8 years ago. You've created life in these.
You know what I'm reminded of two episodes that if I had to mention two episodes that I think were the best we could do, or the ones I feel closest to. We had an idea 3, 4, 5 years in, I don't remember. Edith loses her faith in God. And the way she lost her faith in God, she was we introduced a character on an earlier show. Archie was driving a cab to pick up some extra money at night. And he gave somebody in his cab, had a problem, a physical problem. He gave mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to this woman in the back of his cab. When the woman came to thank the guy who saved her life, it was a transsexual. It was a guy who'd become a woman. I'll remember the name in a moment. She was just glorious. And, of course, Edith answers the door and loves, you know, by the way, if you want to know how we thought about Edith, what would her reaction be to anything? It would be, what would Jesus do? That's how we thought through Edith's character.
I was going to say wonder and awe.
Yeah. Somebody wrote a book. There was a minister who wrote a book called Edith the Good, a wonderful book. And I don't think he knew that we were, you know, framing her that way.
But the construct of Edith in the writer's room was
what would Jesus do? And that's how she would react. So this woman, turns out to be a man, It made no difference to Edith. Another human being. She loved her.
Archie, on the other hand.
Archie came down on and learns that he had given mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to someone who was born a man.
He's drinking Drano.
And but anyway, if this woman, one of us, could have been one of the writers, could have been me, I don't know. One of us wondered if she was killed for who she was by a gang. What would happen to Edith? She would lose her faith in God. She couldn't believe in a God that would see this character murdered.
If the transsexual was killed by people that were...
Yes, just know, because she was transsexual.
I don't know the proper nomenclature, homophobic or anti... You know,
right.
Edith would no longer believe in God.
Edith couldn't believe in a God that could see that happen.
Why couldn't Edith see the less than in her own home? Because Archie was never, ever...
You're going to get the answer to
good.
That.
Good. Thank you, sir. Sorry.
We had a great idea. We knew we had a great idea. If Beverly LaSalle, that's her name, if Beverly LaSalle was killed by people who murdered her because she was who she was, Edith would lose her faith in God. But then we had to think in the next show, because we couldn't leave Edith faithless forever, we had to find out how she recovers, how she regains her faith. And that took many weeks. I mean, we went nuts. I had somebody from the philosophy department at UCLA come in to talk after weeks of scratching our heads. We went on for a long time. How does Edith, what makes her regain her faith? And then one day, innocently, somebody, I don't know, remember who, asked, by the way, what happened to Archie when Edith lost her faith? Then we had the answer. He went to pieces. There was no Archie. He depended on her strength. Her strength came from her faith. That's the way that was. And those two episodes, I couldn't commend them to you more.
Wow. Yeah, it's... I have to sit with that for a moment. the magnitude of that, of she, yeah, WWJ, what would Jesus do? She loses her faith. There's no Archie with no Edith. And that's the time when he shows all his love.
Yes.
Wow. That's, I'm speechless. And I don't know how I missed those episodes. I thought, you know, I'm one of those guys who go, I never missed an episode of this or of that. I'm a transsexual in a cab, mouth to mouth.
I'm gonna get you those episodes.
Okay, and I'll watch them with alacrity.
Alacrity. Is that a man or a woman?
Alacrity. Well, he's sort of like a centaur. He's both. He's a man. He's a woman. He's a horse.
He belongs in this story.
But it's backwards. Like a centaur is a man from like the chest up. Usually, the alacrity is a man from the waist down. So it's a horse head.
Uh-huh.
But you can never really see them because they have the undercarriage has a dingle and a dangle there. So they blur them out. You're not allowed to write. It's like Allah. You can't really put them down on paper.
In any event, it's Mr. Alacrity.
Yes, it is indeed. And he does get offended.
No.
Why do you think, if you had to take a guess and there's no right answer, why is the Buddha smiling? Every statue of the Buddha, there's like that little smirk.
Something to do with a feather someplace.
You said the foolishness of the human condition, and you said it with a smile, a Buddha-like smile.
Yeah.
Something about a feather someplace.
When somebody puts his hand on your shoulder, you're 9 years old, your mother is selling all the furniture, because your father went to prison, she can't live there anymore. And the guy who's buying the red leather chair that you used to sit in your dad's lap and listen to the Friday night fights from Madison Square Garden, and this horse's ass puts his hand on your shoulder and says, well, woman, you're the man of the house now. I understood, whether it was that moment or sometime later, my God, the foolishness of the human condition. What a fool.
And they didn't mean it to be foolish. They meant it as, here you go, buddy. You're up and running.
Yeah. No, and a moment later he was saying, there, Norman, a man of the house doesn't cry.
At 9 years, before you hit double digits.
Yes.
you mentioned Friday Night Fights in Madison Square Garden. Are you,
remember that?
Yeah, of course. Are you a fight fan?
I was a fight fan.
Do you think Doug Jones beat Cassius Clay?
Yes. Was I there?
No, do you think?
But I was there one night when I saw Cassius Clay fight at Yankee Stadium.
Was it Cassius or Muhammad?
Muhammad. Oh. It was Muhammad.
Doug Jones, people don't realize, was the fight before Sonny. I don't think he won either of the Sonny Liston fights. You can get me to go draw in each. Well, not one. It's a knockout, fake knockout. And I always said, if it's not fixed, why was it in a boathouse in Lewiston, Maine, when they had the Boston Garden lined up? But Doug Jones was the fight before Sonny Liston, and it's almost like you had, you know,
it was the Liston fight that I saw.
You saw the Liston fight?
Yeah.
When he came in with Thunderbird Motel on his robe.
Yes.
And people want to know if it was fixed. When he had the stinging eyes, Clay. You were at that fight.
I was at that fight. I have more to the story.
I'm all ears.
I got a call from, I'm trying to remember his name. He's a great writer, book writer, wrote one book. That's what's the book about Sammy, what makes Sammy run? Okay. Bud Schulberg. Bud Schulberg called one day, you want to go to the fight tonight? I said, geez, my friend Ben Bradley is in from D.C. Yes, you both can come. Schulberg was a great fight fan and wrote a great deal about fighting in addition to the books he wrote. He picked us up. We met him in a car. And he was going to I can't remember the name, Ali's publicist's apartment, which was up in the hundreds, 120-something street, and a three-floor walk-up. And there was Ali and this guy and his wife who was ironing his trunks. He was in a bathrobe. And his little girl, she was maybe 10 then. And I had as memorable a moment as I ever had on this planet, watching her, the little girl, put her father's shoes on and tie them herself. And this was a tiny little two-room apartment.
Well, it's the publicist, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
It's not Ali. It's
not Ali.
It's Colonel Parker's.
And then we went out. Then we went downstairs, and we were in escorted out to Yankee Stadium.
My father said the largest man he ever met was Muhammad Ali. He saw him at JFK Airport, and he said he arrived long before he turned the corner. It was like knowing a storm was coming.
Oh, I love that.
And Ali was 6 foot, maybe. I mean, he fought Doug Jones at 188 pounds. He wasn't a giant man.
No, he wasn't.
But he was a giant man.
Yeah.
And I was asked to write an obituary for Lloyd Bridges for a magazine, and I realized Lloyd was the largest man I ever met in my life because his love and his kindness, what you knew when he was on set. You knew when he was in his trailer. You knew when his car arrived because there was a ripple effect. If he was in the middle of the ocean, the wave breaking on the shore was like a piece of that love that he always carried. So you got to see the largest man my father ever met, and you're aware of the magnitude of...
Are you writing a bit, too?
I just started writing poetry and putting them out, but it's the fear of it.
How about a biography?
I've written a couple. When I was on Saturday Night Live, I wrote about me there, me being the villain.
Yeah.
And being a drunk and having panic attacks and being just an overall a kid, you know? And then one about fatherhood, which is the go-to, I can get money by writing about fatherhood because I'm a comic. And then halfway through, you realize, wow, like I'm making myself tear up writing. Like, this is way tender, and I'm going way deep inside. So, yeah, I love to write. I love to write. I put it aside for a long time.
I asked because I thought, my God, is there a big, terrific autobiography in this man?
I don't know. It's you got to be quite a narcissist to go, here's 400 pages about me.
You're a sufficient narcissist. Boom, boom. It's okay.
I am a sufficient narcissist.
Yeah. Not the biggest, but sufficient.
No, certainly not. Who's the biggest man you ever met in your life in any capacity of that definition?
Oh, in any...
By the way, these notes I took all night and this morning, I haven't looked at them once. This is,
I noticed.
No, we're just, we're on the river here, just.
I don't know, it could be, I don't know if I would have thought of it if we hadn't been talking about Ali, but it could be Ali. There was nobody that I met that I can think of that awed me more.
Uncle Jack, I would guess, is Uncle way up there.
But he was comfortable. I mean, yeah. He wasn't, Uncle Jack. You know, I knew Uncle Jack.
Is there enormity in comfort, though?
In comfort?
Just for you at nine to have comfort with a male adult, to have that comfort, that's larger than anything.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've measured that yet.
No, I had that with,
you're just a kid,
with my grandmother.
Oh, yeah.
With my mother's mother. Yeah. She, that was the one person in my kiddom that I was positive loved me. I knew she loved me. And she was the one who spoke less than anybody. I'm not sure she ever said, I love you. But my she didn't have to.
There's tribes in Africa where the men will go out on a retreat with their child, the boy, and they don't speak. And that's how they bond. And I think they touch foreheads, I believe, at the very end. It's a ceremonial, like a week long, 3 week long. You know, they'll run an animal to ground.
Yeah.
They'll clean it. But they never speak. And it's almost like the more we speak as a society, the more we just don't listen at all. Nobody answers a question. Do you guys sell Time magazine? Well, if we do, it's in the magazine. Well, I know I'm at the magazine rack. I'm asking specifically because of its absence. Do you indeed sell it? Nobody seems to listen. It's all like cell phones and swiping and texting. What would you say is...
Maybe that's why podcasts have come to us, have happened.
Yeah.
This is a recent... this is quite recent, the podcast. And maybe it is exactly what you're talking about, that has people reaching out when nobody else is involved.
Hmm.
For that conversation.
The Buddha's smiling because there's a feather someplace. Wow. What is the one thing you know your father did well, if you could only put a positive down for you
one,
as a son?
There's one episode that makes me, when I think about it, I think he was a great, you couldn't count on him much of the time. I was in love with the theater. My favorite play might have been a play called Lilium. It was playing in the West Theater near New York, Westchester. And we were in Hartford. I was picking up my girlfriend Charlotte at 4 o'clock or 3:30 or whatever, and we were driving to this production with Tyrone Power, who was a great star at the time.
Well, yeah.
And his wife, Annabella, a French actress he was married to. It was just, as I think about it now, this was one of the great moments. I was going to go to see Lilium with Charlotte, and I was picking her up in my car. My car was a car I bought with a Sydney. I think we paid $135 for this Ford. And my father said, seeing how important all this was to me, grandstand player, that's the expression I was looking for earlier, my father... A grandstand player.
What does that mean, Norman?
You couldn't count on them unless there was an audience.
Wow.
Then he was playing to the grandstand.
Keeping up appearances. The perception was important.
Yes. Wow. So he said, "I'm coming home early. You can have my car." It was a. I can't remember the make. They didn't make it some years after that.
Better than $135 car.
Oh, my God.
It was greater than.
It was a couple of years old. It was great. And so he's due at, let's say, 3:30, 4 o'clock. He doesn't show. I go out to West Hartford, Connecticut, pick up Charlotte in my rinky-dink, and we drive through Meriden and Wallacefield and, you know, city after city, New Haven, and then we're on the Merritt Parkway.
Danbury, Waterbury.
And the Merritt Parkway all the way to the theater. And I hear honk, 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 10 minutes on the highway. My father's behind me, and he's changes cars with me. And I take Charlotte in his car from there on. That's the kind of grandstand play.
He made his own grandstand.
Once in a lifetime.
He took liminal space and time and put his own grandstand
in. I took that story and made it an episode of Maud. Entirely different, but I don't know if you have time to hear that.
I don't think in my lifetime I'll have enough time to hear what you say.
I could think about that for an hour and a half.
I just
I better not do it. Here.
There's nothing. I will never be full of Norman Lear.
Oh, that's the sweetest thing.
Your eternal.
Thank you. Maud, she was on a. Actually, Maud was all alone. She did one episode where there was nobody else on the screen. She was lying down talking to a psychiatrist. All you ever saw of him was his hand on the edge of a table. You just saw his wrist down. And she talked. She came in saying how she hated her husband. That took her to her father. She was upset with her, Walter. That took her to her father. Her father never did anything for her. She didn't like him. And then suddenly she said, no, wait. And this is an entire half hour she's lying there talking.
The whole show was her. Was
the whole show was her monologue.
That's balls, man.
And at some point in that half hour, she said, no, wait. I'm remembering something. And she tells the story of her high school graduation prom. And she's going to the prom, and Eli or somebody picks her up. And her father, she fell in love with a coat with a Persian lamb collar. Remember every time she said Persian lamb collar? And her father was to pick it up at the store before. Again,
she fell in love with this coat.
Yeah, they bought the coat and they had to fix it.
The Persian lamb. Well, now hear her saying it, and I can't get an echolalia about her saying it.
They had to do a little work on it. I mean, her father was going to pick it up and bring it home before she had to leave. And the same idea. He doesn't come home in time. And she's picked up and she has to go, and she wears her scruffy coat. She doesn't have the great coat with the Persian lamb collar. He comes home, calls the store. He can't get he gets the guy at home somehow. And the guy comes to the store. He gets the coat with the Persian lamb collar and gets to the high school just as she's mounting the steps to go in with her boyfriend. He's there with the coat. That's the story she tells. And she says, oh, yes, I love me. She's crying. I love my father. And she was feeling everything I felt in terms of grandstand player. Look what he could do when he wished to do it.
When you're on the floor of the show and people are patting you on the back saying, that's such a great episode, it's a little bit, I may be projecting, it's a little bit like you're the man of the house. That's so funny, Norman. Yeah. It's great. And a piece of you, there's a bluebird in your heart that's singing pretty loudly, and nobody really hears that bluebird, you're the man of the house, Norman, as, like, there you go. Like, that's so funny that she's sitting there and great episode, buddy. And what they don't realize is that linear line back to where you pulled it from.
So how do you help people understand that that linear line exists for them every day of their lives in some little thing they may do for the next person? Make somebody smile. Make somebody feel relieved for a moment. And given the size and scope of the creator's enterprise here, this being one planet among a billion, in a universe of which they say there are also a billion. Can you get your fingers close enough together to measure the difference in the impact of the little thing that you did today that gave somebody just a moment and something Jonas Salk?
That's why the Buddha's smiling, the distance between those fingers. You can, and we can, but it's, again, it goes to the listening. Like, I have friends that I'll say, well, if you do this, my big thing is you have to let the good in. And we seem to be in a culture and a society now, and I'm not, I can't track it back too far because I'm just aware of my own personal fearless moral inventory, where people will complain and this, and you'll go, hold on a minute. You're caring for your parents. Your dream was just to have your mom be home, for an example. Like, she was always out, hypothetically, like using drugs. Like, as a kid, you were abandoned. Your mom's in your house. You have healthy you have to let the good in. And I see people, I'll do this, it's not life coach, it's like I snowplow a road for people. I'll be hired maybe by a company with a non-disclosure up top, and it's just the signal of good. It gets so stiff-armed, and to get somebody to accept their good qualities, that's what's negotiated. Not the terrible thing that they called because they needed help with it. I'm angry because my sister's a drug addict and I can't see my dying father in the hospital. No. You're afraid to see your father in the hospital because when he dies, he will have abandoned you again. But the good is you can see your father in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And it fascinates me. People will negotiate the good about themselves. Like, I told you you were loving and beautiful and you didn't say, oh, stop. You know you are. And I know I am. And it's people. I'll ask you, what do you think that is, that people will, they will negotiate away from the good about themselves before the that's the ground rules of the conversation, the blueprint. Like, well, you're a compassionate, loving person. Well, you never act out of malice. Well, you know, sometimes. No, you don't. I'm saying it because I know it's true. Mm-hmm. Why do you think people don't let the good in? Is it comfort? Yeah. Is it?
That is such a good question. And despite the 99 years, some months, some weeks. I never heard it before. So I'm wondering, is that 100% true?
No, of course not.
It's reflexive. The reaction is a reflexive reaction. I can't hear myself praise that. You know, certainly not on a human on a human level. That I'm a good human being, or I've been a good human being.
But you know, I mean, it's what I was talking about Buddy Hackett earlier. He told me, what you forget, God remembers. What you remember, God forgets. It's almost like humility. The moment you acknowledge it, it's gone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like grabbing water if you want to go east. And if somebody goes like, I'm really humble, it's like that statement alone, you're disqualified. It's like a white guy going, no, I'm down, you know, with the brothers. Like, just, you said it aloud, you're done. You're disqualified forever. And your grandma, she didn't say anything. You knew there's a channel in there that guys like you, and I'm working on it, can tap into. I know your heart. I know you. I've known you my whole life. You've known me your whole life. And
well, after this amount of time together, a half hour ago, I felt that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. I just met you and it was just, hey, yeah. Do you think the chatter will eventually die down and there will be a rebirth societally where people can just simply just calm down and just stop arguing so much?
Well,
is that inevitable?
It doesn't seem inevitable now, given the racial problems we have in the country, despite, you know, everything that has gone down between World War II and now, with, you know, for an example. I was talking about that. I did a thing with Ava DuVernay today. She's the young black woman who's directed 13th.
Oh, wow.
And, oh, my God, she's so talented and wonderful. And we have a long way to go in recognizing our common humanity, whatever the other guy looks like, whatever his or her skin color or...
What is the common humanity?
Everything What's, you're talking about.
But if you had to succinctly, as a writer, in the writer's room, I need this in a line, Norman. I need a one-line answer or we're getting canceled between Muslim, Jew, black, white,
I
Asian.
Was born of woman and you were born of woman. And we are one. We are human beings. We are. That's our common humanity. Humanity is something else, but that's our common being.
Animal and plant kingdom as well.
Yes.
I always love seahorses, non sequitur, because the male holds the babies after they're born. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. The man, he like, there's like a, I don't know if it's a pouch or whatever, but he holds all, after they're born, he just takes them. Not aggressively. It's just all yeah. seahorses. The man, I have a t-shirt of like all these baby seahorses coming out of a boy seahorse's stomach and people think it's, it looks graphic, odd, like drawing little seahorses. But I always thought, like, obviously you were that kind of father, and that's the kind of father I see myself, like, born of woman. And then guys like you, the first thing is, how can I help this woman that just gave birth to this child? And you want to hold that child. What's the difference, the biggest difference between raising a boy and raising a girl?
I have one boy, five daughters. So one son, five daughters. I think the biggest difference I found was... throwing a ball to him came far more naturally than throwing a ball to a daughter.
Yeah.
I haven't answered this question before. I haven't said that before, so this takes some thought.
But I know why already.
But that's so...
I know why already, though. Because as a father to a girl, that's the Fabergé egg you're throwing at.
Uh-huh.
To a boy, you'll get a little chink in the armor. It's good. You know, you want to... be the cool guy with a couple more. You want dirt on the uniform. You want to show that you played. With the girl, it's, oof. You want to keep the Barbie in the box at all times or it loses its value. I would think maybe that's why.
Yeah.
The awareness of the preciousness and the fragility of the world that girl's about to, because, I mean, you want to talk about racism, misogyny, it's like, it's it's heartbreaking. And with a boy, I think they're a little more equipped in a male culture. I don't know. That's the first
thing
I thought.
They're a little more equipped in a male culture, you're saying.
Yeah,
well, of course.
You're throwing at a Fabergé egg
compared
to a tank, even as delicate as the boy is. That repetition of throwing that ball, that's what I remember with my dad. My dad was an I love you guy. And I say in my stand-up comedy, I say, we're the first, I'm 40, God, Corey, how old am I? 46 years old. We're my generation and below, we're the first generation, you being the outlier, of I love you dads. Mm. And I tell them, I go, there's no joke here. I just need you guys to be aware of the fact that you are the first people to look at your child unprompted and go, yeah, I love you. And the kid accepts it as normalcy. Because when I was a kid, if your dad said, and I'll take it to the audience, when I love you, it was awkward. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad said it once, and I went into my sister Virginia's room, and I said, Dad's drunk. She says, did he hit you? I said, worse. He said, I love you. And she started packing a bag. She started, like, folding clothes and putting them in a suit.
God.
We'll go to the New Jersey State Fair. There's animals there. They're there 24 hours. We can be safe. Because the guy said, I love you. So it's, you...
You're 46.
Yes, sir.
So I sit here, I absolutely can't believe I'm almost 50 years on you. Oh, my God. I mean, I'm sitting here. You're my peer. You're 46. I'm 46. That's the way I feel.
Come again? I'm your what? I'm your peer?
My peer. Yes.
I don't know how that's possible. Yes. I'll be your peer in behind the ribcage.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You're my peer. Yeah. And... And I've got 50 years on my peer. Unbelievable.
At 46 years old, what would you have just walked through the space-time continuum and tapped Norman on the shoulder and said, hey, buddy, what would you have said to that guy? Which is a hacky question, but
What's the question again?
At 46, what would you go through that space-time continuum to tell that guy, hey, buddy, what would be the one message to you at 46?
Is wait till you're 96. You're going to feel like 46 if you're talking to a 46-year-old.
That doesn't help me on the floor of this show where I got all this Michigas going around and everybody's complaining. Like, I mean, that's fascinating. Do you think the 46-year-old Norman Lear would have accepted that message and its
I don't know. I haven't met the 46-year-old Norman Lear yet. I don't remember who he was.
So much forest.
So much learning. So much learning. You know, I've had insights in the last couple of years. That amazed me.
That's like saying Paul had
about me.
Right. You know, that's like saying Paul the Apostle had a few things to say after a while. You know, it's, you know, the mystery of the gospel has not been known until now. Paul the Apostle said, I just was reading that last night thinking to myself, I've never heard of any holy man share this line with me, the admission of the mystery. And I think that's what
made him say it's known now.
It has not been known until now. I don't know.
I mean, that's what mystery still exists, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, that's my interpretation of it. But it's,
so, Paul, you're wrong.
Where is he? Well, go get him. Is Paul on the phone?
He's listening.
Yes, he is. What's your favorite? If you could bring any animal back from extinction, which animal would you bring back? In full populace, you know. Full up and running.
I had a German Shepherd named Grau.
You're the second person in maybe 100 times that's took an actual personal animal. Yeah. It's always like saber-tooth tiger, Reggie Watson, pterodactyls. And I was like, oh, that'd be amazing. Nobody would have a Prius ever again if a pterodactyl could land on the roof. But your dog Growl.
And I've never had one before since that I felt that was so close. It was all a question of timing, how it all came together in that time of my life. But we've had dogs because my kids have had dogs and cats and so forth. And, you know,
went through trauma with Growl. There was something.
Sorry?
You went through a trauma with Growl. Growl was your confidant. Something happened.
Well, because he died.
No, I mean, when he was alive, you had personal trauma.
I did.
And you shared that with Growl. That was your guy. Because the way you got real melancholy and happy at the same time with Growl. Like, there's something shared with that guy.
Yeah.
Well, how old are you around with Growl?
Oh, I was in my 40s, early 40s.
Death of a parent?
I was 46. was you.
Did a parent die then?
No. No.
No?
No.
It's amazing, like the animals we have, we tell them everything. You come home from work, you look at a little Yorkie, and you go, you know what, Mabel? And the dog looks up at you like, yeah, yeah, doesn't matter. We're here now, presence. No, we're completely pushing it on the animal. For all we know, the animal's thinking, where's Paul?
You know, this shepherd was a good friend gave him to me. He was born in Germany. He was raised to a point. Tamed or raised, or which is the right
raised
word?
Raised and trained.
So he might have been a year and a half old, and he had been extremely well trained. And he was flown over. My friend who gave me the dog said, make sure he's going to arrive late afternoon. Do not feed him. Feed him the next morning. You be the one to feed him. He will be forever your dog. It was difficult not to feed him because it was clear the dog had been, you know, a great many hours. But I listened to him, and I fed him the next morning. He called me the next morning, my friend, and he said, by the way, I've never really told this story, so it's always so sensitive to me to get it across. But he wanted me to understand that despite the fact that the dog had been raised, obviously, by somebody in another country and had a deep relationship with that person, and I give him one meal and he's my dog. He wanted me to understand that that was not a measure of the dog's ability to love or consistency in love, or, and I don't remember how he taught me this, but the fact that he was thinking, he didn't want me to think less of the dog because the dog had transferred his love for Emil.
What's your friend's name?
He was a great sculptor, Robert Graham.
Robert Graham. Yeah. And I think Robert Graham knew that you were the dog. Because...
Oh, my.
He knew you were the dog. Good. Don't think less of the dog, because he's just like you. You all of a sudden, your allegiance has to switch to whoever's raising you, and you're going to love unconditionally. Don't think less of the dog, because they fed you, Norman.
That's so good. That is so good.
I love you.
So that's why I got up this morning to come here.
I love you.
I love you, too.
That's I need to convey to you.
Oh, my God.
More Stories Podcast. Norman Lear is a podcast called All of the Above. If you don't subscribe to it, listen to this. We're talking about listening and being present and the foolishness of the human condition. This is not a man that looks at clicks and looks at what are the ratings? Well, how are my rankings? What are the comments? How's my Amazon banner looking? It's a gift, this podcast, because I will never run out of time.
This podcast that we're just concluding is the gift, my friend.
You're delightful, and I can't wait to talk to you again. I can't wait to listen and hear and accept you again and again and again. That's why my Buddha's smiling. I've had it all wrong all these years. I'm going to talk.
Where's your feather?
Sit across from me, and I'm going to give it to the bluebird in my heart. I'm going to put it back on the bluebird. Norman Lear, of course, all of the above, my friends. Brother, I love you. Put your name on it, friends. Go out there and love somebody. If you can't find the heart, be the heart. There you have it. More stories.
From Television City in Hollywood.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made. Those were the days.
And you do when you were there.
Dance for girls and men, Mister. We could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. Ben did no welfare state.
Everybody pulled his weight.
G.R.O. was now and great.
No.